Woe to you, O earth and sea, for the devil sends the beast with wrath, because he knows the time is short. Let him who hath understanding reckon the number of the beast, for it is a human number. Its number is 666.
Herzlich willkommen zum Metal.de Podcast, der Podcast über Heavy Metal und allem, was dazugehört. Am Mikro begrüßt euch euer Gastgeber Henning.
Moin Moin und herzlich willkommen zu einer weiteren Folge vom Metal.de Podcast. Diese Woche bringen wir euch ein Gespräch mit dem amerikanischen Podcast Pots and Swords und seinem Gastgeber Greg Smith. Greg und ich sind riesen Stephen Wilson Fans. Stephen Wilson ist vielleicht einigen von euch als Bandleader und Mastermind der Band Porcupine Tree ein Begriff. Steven wandelt ja jetzt schon seit einigen Jahren solo durch die musikalische Weltgeschichte und wir schauen uns mal seine ganzen Solo-Alben wirklich Track für Track an. Hat uns wahnsinnig viel Spaß gemacht, ist sehr lang, sehr detailliert, aber wir sind beide, wie gesagt, riesen Wilson-Fans und Nerds und haben uns da echt Zeit gelassen. Von daher viel Spaß beim Hören. Wir hatten auf alle Fälle Riesenspaß, dieses Gespräch zusammenzuführen.
Craig Smith, and welcome once again to the Album by Album series on the Pods and Sods Network. To anybody who's listened to Pods and Sods more than casually, you'll know that probably my favorite musician, bar none, is a gentleman named Stephen Wilson, who used to front the band Porcupine Tree. We've had several episodes about him to date. I'll link those in the show notes. But today, I have a very special guest to talk about Stephen Wilson's solo career. Why don't you introduce yourself real quick?
Okay, hi. I'm Henning Mielke. I'm from Germany, based in Munich. And yeah, just been a listener, podcasts and Pots and Swords and all the other good stuff for quite a while now. In abundance, there's a lot of great podcasts coming out, and obviously Craig, what you do with Eric and all this stuff, you know, I'm a huge fan. So really privileged and honored to be part of this. I mean, Stephen Wilson, I worked for East West and Warner Music in Atlantic for a while. And I know that when Atlantic signed Porcupine Tree for the In Absentia, he, you know, I saw him at the office once in a while. So, but he was great. I mean, such a nice guy. You interviewed him.
Yeah, we did. We did. When Hand Cannot Erase came out. Were you a fan at the time when he was stopping by the offices?
With that record, I got into it.
Okay.
That was my introduction. Then, you know, it kind of spiraled from there. And now that's the reason why we do this. I feel the same way like you do. For me, he's exactly, bar none, the most gratifying artist I know at this point, and I just with every album, especially with the solo stuff, I just got deeper and deeper in the fandom of Mr. Stephen Wilson.
Yeah, I became a fan probably around the same time as you did, maybe one album before. And I'm curious if you agree, the thing that drew me most initially to Porcupine Tree was that it really was a mixture of every type of music I loved and really didn't incorporate anything I didn't like. So when the music got heavy, the vocals never got screamy. You know, the vocals were always very melodic, a lot of harmonies. And he was just always a master at mixing every sound that's pleasant to my ears. And I think that's probably, you know, there have been a lot of people that I've introduced Porcupine Tree and Stephen Wilson to, and there have been the few that didn't take to it. And I have to think that's why it might just contain some genre in there that person just might not get, because I don't understand. He's never put a bad foot forward, in my opinion. All of these solo albums are winners, and every time a new one comes out, there's that part of me that expects, you know, this is going to be the one that's going to lose me. And it hasn't happened yet. Thankfully.
Same for me. I mean, I think it's exactly how you describe it. For me, it's always this mixture between, you know, quiet and loud and darkness and light. And it's just what I really love about him is the whole package. I mean, his the artwork, the way he approaches his albums, the visuals. I also totally agree with you. I think his vocals, I think for which he gets criticized once in a while, I think from the prog metal or whatever sector. I think it's actually a good thing that he's not a straight up, you know, shouter or really. I think that just adds to the pop sensibility that he has, and it's, I mean, it's just so gratifying. I mean, his music is and then, you know, the production is always top notch. His musicians, the stuff he has. I mean, I'm a huge Gavin Harrison fan.
Amazing.
You know, and I wish he would be the guy, you know, for Stephen Wilson's solo band. But you know, but I think it's just great. I think and the songs and you know, and then, you know, he hits you with one chorus and you think it's that's gonna be it, and then he comes out with another section, and it's just great. And I introduced him to a lot of people. Some really love him. I think Germany has always been a very good country for him from the beginning. I think we have these tendencies here to really you know, cherish these kind of artists, and the people, you know, I played it to which I thought would like it, really, really liked it. And so, I mean, I had good response so far, except my wife. I mean, she doesn't get it. That's fine.
Yeah, I do understand that. I was actually going to ask you kind of his level of popularity in Germany, because I might go out on a limb and say in America, what he may be known for more is his production and remixing work on the catalogs of vintage classic artists.
Right.
And I might only be saying that because I'm kind of in audiophile circles with a lot of people that collect vinyl or collect music. So that's where they know his name. It's funny. I went to I got my turntable set up a couple weeks ago at a place near here, and they were talking about his remix of Chicago 2. And I had to mention, you know, I've been a fan since Porcupine Tree, and the guy knew who Porcupine Tree was, and I was surprised. So, I mean, I wish that his music would be more recognized here, but it's tough in this kind of pop this pop saturated marketplace. But I introduce him to as many people as I possibly can.
How is he doing in the States? I mean, overall, is it more like an East Coast thing, like New York, Chicago?
I mean, those are the places where I've seen him. You know, I followed Porcupine Tree for a couple dates on the Fear of a Blank Planet tour. And so I saw him in New York, Philly, Milwaukee, Chicago, a couple shows in Jersey. So I really only know about the East Coast, and you know, they filled theaters. I actually saw, I was very thankful for this. I saw the show they did at Radio City Music Hall, which ended up being kind of their swan song in the U.S. Wow. For wow. the Incident Tour. And wow. I didn't know at the time, of course, that it was kind of going to be their last, but it was just an amazing show, like 3 hour wow. plus show. And I'm so thankful that I was able to go see that.
That's great.
But yeah, I mean, it's always been kind of a theater audience, and he still kind of plays the same kind of places maybe as a solo artist. Nothing too big around here, but always packs it, you know.
Right. So the album charts top, you know,
yeah.
what, top 100 Billboard.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it was, I think it hit number one on Amazon in the U.S.
Wow.
Which I think probably in 2017 is a pretty good feat, you know, in the right. age of downloading, you know.
Right. That's great.
And I do also want to drive home to use a Steve Wilson song title. The that was accidental.
I know you do that. I love it. Yeah, no, it's great.
That one was truly accidental. You mentioned his production. He is anything lately. I guess you maybe all of his solo albums after Grace for Drowning are all works of art in terms of production. He
absolutely.
He has a very light touch, and he's a big proponent of leaving dynamics. Some of those early Porcupine Tree albums are really, really compressed. I see that they're re-releasing In Absentia and Dead Wing. Hopefully,
He got the rights back.
Yeah,
I saw that.
He had mentioned during the interview that he did with us. I think we were talking about that. Because I think I said something about how those albums sounded the worst in the catalog. And right. He had said at that point he couldn't get rights to them. So I'm looking forward to the vinyl on those, and they're supposed to be released on CD the year after. So
yeah, I can wait.
Yeah,
I
I'm wait. Very excited, yeah. especially if they're remastered to sound as good as what he's been doing now. Deadwing and In Absentia are great, great records that are really heavily compressed and produced, so it'll be nice to kind of hear them in a different light.
I just bought Deadwing, I think Japan import 5.1, which is kind of hard to get, so I'm kind of trying to recollect stuff, but that's I can only get it from Amazon, so that's and it's always a little bit pricey. So
do you buy the vinyl as well?
I have yet to buy myself a turntable in lack of space, but I got the go-ahead from my wife, so I'm
watch
just
out.
About. Yeah, watch out! Really fought tooth and nail for that. So, I think I'm gonna buy a turntable. Yeah, I think, and I have to say it's mainly because of him.
Yeah,
you know, because I think it's such a treat to listen to his records, and you know, and I know we both are probably the same age group. I mean, we were raised on vinyl, and mm-hmm. it's just you know, and he put so much care and effort in his package, in the deluxe version, in the books he does. I mean, you know, I mean, how can you not get everything, you know,
yeah.
and make that a worthwhile thing for him, you know. And coming back to your question, initial question for Germany, and yeah, he's huge here. I mean, I think all
really?
His album, yeah, all his album were at least top five over here.
Wow.
Yeah, he's big. He's big over here.
So does he get radio play?
No.
Okay.
No, but I think he draws. You know, Germans are known for being very loyal. I think there are a lot of people who follow him from, you know, the early days, and they go, you know, they went with him to No Man and to Blackfield and
all these various side places. Projects. Yes.
Yeah, and you know, I think and we are very much still a physical product market, which is odd. So And I think he has such a loyal fan base over here. And I know he played a lot of for the new record. He played a lot of TV stuff and radio. You could really see that, you know, he stepped up, or Universal stepped up the game in terms of promo and getting him out on TV and stuff like that. But I mean, we're going to get to that album. I'm not sure that really... I haven't seen any difference in you know, what his... I think he still appeals mainly to his core fan base without any radio, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, you mentioned physical product. Maybe the thing that made me become a fan quicker than anything was... my friend had bought me a Porcupine Tree CD for my birthday. And as I started to listen more and get into them, one day I visited their website and saw all of the B-sides, all of the singles. And I remember shortly after I took a vacation to San Francisco and bought a bunch of Porcupine Tree stuff at Amoeba Records in San Francisco. And that was really when I started to collect. If not for that, I looked at that as a challenge to get everything, and that will really entice a collector and probably sped up the process of becoming a fan, just because there was so much to get into and so much to find, and still is. But back to the vinyl thing for a second, it's you know, in the early days of Porcupine Tree, like, those vinyl editions were so limited. And thankfully, as the years have went on, he has reproduced several of them many times. So, you know, it's, if you wait long enough, you know, a cycle should come around again where you can get everything again, I would hope, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and then his stand on streaming that, you know, for a long time, he, you know, you couldn't get all his stuff on any streaming platform, and it's just, you know, he has a very interesting you know, opinion about, you know, physical product and what it all entails. And I have to say, the hand cannot erase package, I mean it's just unbelievable.
Amazing. I'm sure we'll get there.
Yeah.
All right, so should we start from the first solo album proper?
Absolutely.
Okay. It should also be known that, I mean, he did stuff prior to this, obviously, in Porcupine Tree. He had a he ended up releasing a solo album full of electronic music and experimental stuff that was even earlier than that. There's no way we would ever be able to hit everything in one podcast. So we're going to do kind of the
Lord of the Rings right. trilogy, right. You know, 4 hours.
It would probably be even longer. There are hundreds of releases. There's a PDF file out there. I wish I could remember.
I've seen it.
I wish I could remember who did it offhand, but I'll put a link
it's
to
scary.
It also.
It's scary.
Yeah. It's a scary PDF thing. That has everything he had been in. And it's, I don't think it's been updated in the last few years. And it's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of releases that all bear his name in some form. So maybe the most prolific musician with his first solo album proper, which would be Insurgents. Give me some thoughts about this album. Maybe kind of how you felt about it when you first heard it.
That one, I think what struck me first, so foremost, was obviously the album cover, which was kind of interesting and disturbing. And then I have to say, and that's probably something that we're going to have maybe return once in a while, his partnership with, I'm going to butcher his name, Lasse Olle, I think that's his name.
Sounds about right, yeah.
Yeah, I should know, I'm from Europe. it's yeah, I have to say that is really such a strong and integral part of, again, his whole package. You know, they've been working, you know, together for I don't know how long, even in the Porcupine Tree days. I think it started off. I'm not sure, but I mean, the visuals, the videos, the whole atmosphere is always such a big part of his you know, catalog and what he releases, and it's always with a lot of thought. So the album is kind of I think you can. I like it. It's probably my least favorite in his catalog because some things, there's a lot of electronic drone stuff on it. There are some beautiful, beautiful ballads on it and some really atmospheric stuff. It's not as cohesive as his other releases. I think you could see he was coming off Porcupine Tree. He was not. He went back, I think, to did.
The incident was right after this, yeah.
Right. So he was kind of still feeling out himself as a solo artist and trying a lot of stuff, a lot of influences. I think what you can see is that, you know, his remix work, which you mentioned, is not that influential to a solo record, not as much as it's going to be in the future. And I like it. I mean, I love all his stuff, so I had a really hard time figuring out or make it, you know, decisive call on which are my favorite or least favorite records. So but I love it, and if I have to pick a song, I mean, probably the title track. I mean, that's such an amazing ballad. I mean, he does ballads. I'm usually not a huge ballad fan, but his ballads are just, I think you said it in your episode with for Hand Cannot Erase, that he pulls on the heartstrings, and he's just amazing in that way.
Yeah, let's slip in a little bit of the title track here.
Now out of death, you speak in tongues. And out of breath, your work is done. And your dream absorbs.
To agree with you, it's probably my least favorite. It's one that I usually wouldn't go back to, and when I did go back to it to start prepping for this episode, I was pleasantly surprised at how much I did enjoy it. Because as each new one has come out, I usually spend a lot of time with the new one, and it's still the same, you know.
Right.
But did you see the film for this?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I bought it.
Okay. Yeah. I went to see it in New York when he screened it in New York. He was there and did a Q&A. It's a very self-indulgent album. And I don't even mean that to sound insulting, but it does feel like to me kind of the stuff that. Maybe he was frustrated that he couldn't fit into Porcupine Tree or, you know, that he felt needed to be something different. So it did kind of feel at the time a little scattershot. Like there are some long, as you said, some drone, there are some long repetitive tracks. And I don't want to jump on the ballad train, but to me, again, since you had, but to me, the standout track, and I'll butcher this, Veneno para las Hadas, I think is beautiful.
Oh, it's ridiculous.
And just beautiful. The, you know, it's just that sound. Let me slip a little bit of it here.
Nothing left, just bottle not.
It's just that kind of, synth sound on this, or keyboard sound that really makes this song. And, you know, you could totally, with all these albums, make a great, great disc of just his mellow or atmospheric stuff, and it would be great, you know?
Totally.
Yeah.
Maybe I should do that for my wife. That would be the trick.
That's what's gonna do it.
That's what's gonna get me.
Yeah, and it should be said that Gavin Harrison plays drums on most of this record.
Yeah, and I love him. I think he is, for me, probably my favorite prog rock drummer at the moment. I just love him. I think he's so outstanding.
Yeah, I think Craig Blundell, who plays with him now, is great.
He's amazing too. Yeah, absolutely.
But the first time I saw Gavin, you know, anytime I saw Porcupine Tree, I think I watched Gavin the whole night. You know, he is just a lead drum player, and you know, the fills are never the same, and it was just always a work of art to watch. But yeah, I think I agree. This would, you know, usually on these album by album things, we rate them, but I didn't even bother doing that for these because it really, what I thought they were ended up changing when I started listening to them again. And then it's really what you're in the mood for.
Like, absolutely.
I think I can confidently put this one at the bottom just because of its it's less cohesive than the others.
Right.
But I think that any one of the others could share the top spot or maybe number two at any given time. So
totally agree. And the I think Veneno, there's a great live version on the Get All You Deserve live album,
yes,
which is really good.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's a beautiful track.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So let's move on to the next. Oh, by the way, that came out in 2008, November 2008. Eight. Yes.
Right.
And then, of course, following that,
and it was on his label, right? He had this label, this Headphone Dust.
It was on Headphone Dust.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it came out on Tone Float, K Scope, but his Headphone Dust label.
Right. Is he involved in that? I don't know.
Right. I know though that goes back way back to when I first got into Porcupine Tree. But I don't know. I should, that is something I should probably look into. Actually, let's take a look here. See what it says. On Wikipedia, it is an independent record label that is part of Snapper Music. Doesn't say anything specifically about, it says the label was initially used exclusively by Stephen Wilson and Porcupine Tree. So Snapper Music was distribution.
Right.
So yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Got
there
it.
You go. Okay.
Okay.
And then they signed the Pineapple Thief.
They have a lot of stuff. It's actually quite a good album. Good little label. I think they have a lot of good stuff.
Yeah.
Right.
So then, of course, Porcupine Tree puts out their final album, The Incident. So that explains kind of a 3-year gap between the last and this album.
And I heard him. Did he say that on your interview that The Incident was actually meant to be a movie soundtrack to a film?
Oh, no, that wasn't our podcast. No.
I think he mentioned it somewhere.
Really?
I cannot remember. Yeah, I might have read it. I think he kind of had a movie project, not about him, just some kind of where he was scoring or somehow involved, and then that didn't get realized, and then he had all this music, and then I think he just kind of put it under the Porcupine Tree and did it, you know, under that umbrella. And it's because it is a concept album, right?
Oh, about definitely. This, yeah.
Yeah. About this car accident or the family. I have to take a look at it. Yeah.
Are you a fan of that record?
I know it's on the mood.
Okay. I know it's low for a lot of people, but for me, it's maybe one of the top three Porcupine Tree albums.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah. Yeah, you totally hit it, you know, hit the nail on the head. I think it, for me with him, it's never that I'm not liking his album. It's the kind of, you know, what kind of mood you're in. Yeah. And if you get yourself into that kind of mindset, and it's definitely not an to listen to casually, you know, with all his stuff, it's, you know, it's headphone music. You really have to sink in. I like it. I like it a lot.
Yeah.
And I think my favorite at the moment, but that might change again, you know, in 2 weeks for Porcupine Tree is Fear of the Black Planet.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I really like that one the moment.
That'll be our follow-up episode, probably. It's going to have to happen at some point. So then in September of 2011, he released his second solo album proper, which is called Grace for Drowning.
Yeah.
This is a double disc set. So if anything, if my issue with the first album was its kind of all over the place roadmap, this one, it might shoot a little too high. It's a lot to take in.
I know.
It was a lot for me to take in at the time.
It's like his bitch's brew.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It's like this, he comes off this pre-jazz, I think, where he just kind of lets it go, you know, this jazz art rock, King Crimson. I think he did the remixes for a couple of their albums. So I think it's just like, he kind of, you know, it just lets it go at some point, and it just, it's overwhelming. I have a really hard time getting through that album in one sitting.
Yeah, I think you have to break it down into the two halves.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's. I mean, and they both have different titles. The first album is Deformed to Form a Star. The second album is Like Dust I Have Cleared From My Eye.
Do you think that's intentionally? Do you think he actually wanted to have two, you know, solo records, and then he just kind of thought, oh well, you know, let's just stick them together?
I don't know. I thought when it came out, I thought maybe it was kind of the just labeling them different as kind of like a grand statement. You could sequence this album many different ways between the two discs, and it'll still work. So it's not like the albums are different, you know, aside from track lengths. But I think it was just maybe kind of like a, you know, just kind of a statement more than just these are two separate records. I think it was just kind of like a gimmick to label them differently.
You know? Right. Right. Okay.
It should said that this is the first album that you get an appearance from Nick Beggs, who of course was the bass player for Kajagoogoo. That's right.
Yeah.
And maybe one of the best bass players I've ever seen play.
Yeah, he's great.
Amazing. Anybody that hasn't watched him play Chapman Stick.
No, he's great.
Needs to check that out on YouTube. So thoughts on Grace for Drowning?
I totally agree with you. It's the same, you know, like I said, it's a lot of overwhelming stuff. It's the first record that I really, you know, I was a fan, and I really was anticipating that record. There's some really, really beautiful, again, great songs. I mean, Radio 2 obviously is like a magnus opus, you know, 23 minutes. It's just ridiculous. Miles Davis, like we said, you know, Bitches Brew. There's some stuff I think he could have left out, but then again, I think he never, you know, put stuff in as fillers. I think they all serve a purpose. I think you can really see where, you know, that his music is a lot of soundtrack-like stuff where you always have like a visual, again, like a movie,
right?
You know, in your head, where you can kind of see that being a scene or music to a scene. I have to say the record has one of my favorite songs of his. It's No Part of Me.
I feel worn out. There's no point drinking when life slows right down and holds you up above the waterline. So sleep will never come. One last time then. Don't have to pretend. I know that love for you was just security. There's no part of me in you.
Starts really interesting and really you know, atmospheric, and then it kind of breaks down in the middle, you know, into this instrumental where it's just all over the place with the sax, and kind of gets into this thing. And that's actually what I, like I said, what I love about him. He takes you one way, and then it's just a, you know, you think you know where he's going, and then it's just he just takes a U-turn or a totally different turn, and it still works. It never feels, it feels alien the first time, but then you kind of see where he wants to go, and then it kind of really all makes sense, you know. And I love that song. I love that song.
Yeah, and I mean, these albums really do benefit from repeated listenings. You know,
yeah.
Once you get the twists and turns down, they open up so much more. You know. It's and it's funny.
Where would you rate him as a lyricist?
As a lyricist, if anything, I think that might be his weakest spot. I think they're getting better.
I
always thought that. Let me think of an example. Like Fear of a Blank Planet was.
Yeah.
It's a great album, but I always felt that it leaned too heavily on references to the pills and, you know, writing from a teenager's point of view.
Right.
And I don't think he always succeeded. I think as years went on, he became a better lyricist. But I think some of the Porcupine Tree stuff is really, really simple lyrically.
Right.
What are your thoughts?
Do you think he's because sometimes I feel the same, but do you think he's writing from an autobiographical point, or is he more the storyteller, especially with Fear of the Black Planet? You know, like, there's always this depression,
yeah,
drinking, alcoholic, you know, all this stuff. Do you think he just made it up, or is that part of his character makeup at that time?
I never thought that, or I don't think many of his lyrics are autobiographical. I think that he likes to hone in on pieces of society that he feels are lacking or wrong. In this case, kind of like the zombifying of children via, you know, prescription drugs to stabilize moods, you know. I think that that's just kind of
a, he's a good observer.
Yeah. I think that's what it is. But I think, I think once his solo career started to kind of kick off a little more, his lyrics became a little more, maybe the scope got a little wider, and I think that he started to become better at it. You know, it's funny. We were talking about the length of this album. For those that can't get enough of this album, let's not forget there's a disc 3 of demos and outtakes and a Blu-ray. You can never quite get
ridiculous.
Enough.
It's ridiculous. And his demos, it has to be said, his demos are better than most other records.
Oh my God.
From other people. Yeah. It's ridiculous.
I'm sure we'll hit that when we get to the last record, because there are songs in that it's ridiculous aren't on the album. Let's see, if I was to pick a song from this, you know, it's interesting, like, Remainder of the Black Dog and Raider 2, which are kind of the epics on this album, maybe, yeah. And I might be in the minority, they're probably my least favorites from this.
Right.
And I don't know why, I just never connected with them the way I connected with something like Arriving Somewhere But Not Here from Porcupine Tree.
Yeah, that's a great track.
Yeah, there are epics that come later in his solo career that I love, but these two just, they might have been, I think... This and the next album kind of go, this one maybe a little more jazz and the next one maybe a little more prog than is my usual comfort zone, which would be kind of straightforward Porcupine Tree kind of thing. But but I don't not enjoy them. They're just not at the top of the pile for me. I think that I would go, let's listen to a little bit of Postcard.
I'd like to light a cigarette, but I cannot. The light is dead and the gas has been cut off. Ooh. I'm the one you always seem to read about. Inside my eyes is long gone out. There's nothing left for me to say or do. 'Cause all of matters disappeared when I lost you.
This was the kind of the single, if you could call a digital release a single, from the record. It's a really simple song, and he's got these songs that are very simple in their chord structure and their kind of verse chorus patterns, but really open up. And what happens in Postcard at the end, when the kind of choir of vocals open up after the last line, it's just kind, you know, the majestic sound is really what made that track for me and still gets me every time.
It has to be said, he's probably his backing vocals with himself.
Oh, amazing.
I mean, the way he sings it is just unbelievable. I mean, it's just, he's doing such a great job with, you know, adding up those vocals. Yeah, it's great.
I would love to watch him at work doing this stuff and see what the process is like.
Me too.
So yeah, you know, just it's a very sprawling album. I think that was the word I was looking for.
Okay.
It's the least reined in, but plenty of great stuff on here. Nothing really lacking. But
nothing sticks. I mean, for me, you know, I listen to it, and then for me, it's just sometimes hard to kind of remember, and then to you know, I don't know. He wasn't, but it's not a songwriter hour. It's like jazz. You know?
I would agree. And it should be said that the tour for this, we'll kind of just talk about it really quickly. A DVD was released in 2012, September 2012, called Get All You Deserve, which is taken from the Grace for Drowning tour. Did you see that tour?
No, I did not. Oh. I only saw him once.
Really?
Can you believe it? Oh, I only saw him once, yeah.
Which tour was it?
Ham Cannot Erase.
Okay, we'll talk about that when we get there then, because that was the last time I saw him. I did see all the tours and the Porcupine Tree tour since In Absentia. So this was a good one. First time that he kind of did all this stuff live. Also saw him at an in-store where he did an acoustic version of Postcard and Deformed to Form a Star, which was also very cool.
Did he kind of totally avoided playing Porcupine Tree repertoire, right, on those tours?
Yes. Yeah. The first time he did, I think, was the next tour he did. The encore was Radioactive Toy. And then after that, he started to put more in. And now you can usually get 3-4 songs maybe in a set.
Yeah.
You know, which is good.
I think he's going to play, maybe he's going to play more for the next tour.
Really?
You know, I don't know. Yeah, might be.
I'm really curious to see.
Yeah, me too.
I did see something online where he was soliciting requests to do like an acoustic part of the show where he would do a different song every night, which would be pretty cool because his set list kind of usually stays pretty static.
So
the album that follows, of course, on that tour for Grace for Drowning, we heard a preview of the first track for this next record live. And the album is The Raven That Refused to Sing and Other Stories in Parenthetical. February 2013, not as much of a concept album as it is a group of songs that kind of are based on ghost stories. And this one kind of has, I think, maybe the heaviest kind of prog element, especially in Luminol. So your thoughts on The Raven That Refused to Sing?
I love it. I have to say, I mean, I think what you can really tell that, I think his dad died during the recording. So, you know, like you said, it's an album about ghosts and mortality. It's a dark subject matter. Great. I think he really has crafted some great stories. This time, I think he really stepped up his game in terms of storyteller. The production is outstanding, I have to say.
Beautiful.
I think Alan Parsons engineered it, which obviously is never a bad thing.
No.
I really like it. I mean, Luminol is a tough cookie.
Yeah.
I hated that song. But if you prevail and stick to it, it really is gratifying at the end with all that pop, you know, sensibilities he's bringing in later. And I have to say, who really shines for me here, obviously it's a band effort. This time he has all the same musicians for every track, and Guthrie Govan is just God.
Lead guitar, yes.
Yeah, he's just God.
Amazing.
I mean, the solo for Drive Home,
beautiful.
For me, it has to be. It's one of my favorite guitar solos, and I think the story goes that, I think he was just warming up and something like that, or just kind of coming up with ideas, and Steve and Alan said, well, we're gonna keep it, and he's like, no, I can do it better, and then it never had the same magic, and it's just such an amazing solo, and the whole band, you can really, I think they were all together in a room, and it was almost like live. And I think it's a very, very strong record, and it's not as cohesive maybe as the next one, but it's pretty damn close, and I really, really like it. And you know, for me, there are a lot of, you know, the title track again is, and I know you guys talked about the video. The video is just heartbreaking.
Oh my God!
To that one, yeah. And then, you know, I think it has to be Drive Home, because that's
just, your pick?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You need to clear away all the jitter in your brain and face the truth. Well, I can make amends, but while the darkness always ends, you're still alone.
I'm taking all the ballads now, but I'm kind of, I was just like,
people are going to think that he doesn't rock. We'll have to rectify that
next few albums. It's just his, totally. No, I mean, it's, that track is just really a great video as well.
Oh yeah.
I think I have to give him so much credit for producing these kind of videos in a day and age where there's no MTV and there's maybe only the internet.
Yeah.
And he put so much care and effort in producing these videos. It's just very honorable from him.
Yeah, it's not just the video, it's the whole package. Like every album every album has been released in a deluxe edition book. With tons of I mean, it's not just pictures. It's, you know, the whole concept spreads from the videos shown during the show to the books included in the deluxe editions and the vinyl. It's, they're just amazing. It's like every one of these has been cinematic in its presentation, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Which is just so great. It's like every album is an event. Let's see. I think I'm going to have to go with a little bit of the title track here because it's, I think that it's just
my number two. That was my number two.
It's just an amazing piece of work. The Raven That Refused to Sing. During the Stupid Dream tour, he would introduce Stop Swimming as the saddest song he ever wrote, and then that was replaced by Heart Attack and a Lay-By, and then I think it was replaced by this. Anybody who has watched this video and didn't shed a tear, whether it was watching it on YouTube or I'm telling you, I think it might have been the first time I saw it, may have been at the show. And I was weeping.
Oh, that's right.
You know, it was crazy. I love how the one time that Steven Wilson uses auto-tune on a record as an effect really is to have the sound of the Raven on this song,
which
is great, you know, just a great little effect and, you know, just another kind of orchestral masterpiece for a song that's actually, you know, probably really simple. It is
and
just
real strings. It's always real strings. Yeah. I mean, you know, I don't know, you know, his recording budget is not small, it seems, you know.
No.
He's putting so much money into the recording. I mean, it's real strings, it's so much stuff, you know.
Yeah.
He's really it's organic.
Definitely. It's a great album. I would have said before this episode or before I started listening that this one may have been on the bottom for me. And then, when I started listening to it again, I don't know what it was. I just never spent as much time with this one, as much as the others. And I was, again, pleasantly surprised, I think, with this one and the first one, with how much I did enjoy it.
It's great.
Another great album. They're going to get better as we go.
Oh, yes.
But following this, I almost forgot to mention Cover Version, which came out June 2014, and we don't have to spend
to
spend a ton of time about this because it's not really an album proper. But between 2003 and 2010, he put out a series, or he would put out one single. There were six different singles that came out, and they were just called simply Cover Version. So the point being, that you would not know the song until you listen to it. And there's no mention on the packaging what the song is or who wrote it. And then on the B-side would be a song, an original song that he felt complemented the A-side in some way. So the six singles, they were all compiled and put on this album, which is available as an LP and a CD now. Now the songs are listed. They're no longer a surprise. But if you did order these, as I did, these were the surprises that you would have gotten by buying these. In March 2003, cover version one was a cover of Thank You by Alanis Morissette. He would later cover that live with Blackfield. And also put it on a best of album later on, which will mention that kind of in passing in a little bit. The second cover version in October 2004 was a cover of ABBA's The Day Before You Came. He is a huge ABBA fan, and that cover is brilliant. Cover version 3 in September 2005 was A Forest by The Cure.
Right.
Cover version 4 in July 2006 was The Guitar Lesson by Momus. Cover version 5, July 2008, Sign of the Times by Prince. And cover version, which he's playing now, since Prince has passed, he's playing it again live.
Yes, he did.
And cover version 6, a cover of Lord of the Reedy River by Donovan in February 2010. It's a good album, but it's, you know, it's essentially a compilation of six singles. But it's worth checking out because they're all very cool. This is all going to a really good place with a masterpiece, which was released February 2015. I think you would agree. The album Hand Cannot Erase.
Yes.
So yes. This
flawless.
Absolutely flawless. Yes. I remember when I got it, my girlfriend lives in Chicago, so we're very far. And okay. I can't remember if I had introduced her to Stephen Wilson at that time, but I sent her a copy of the record and we synced up and listened to it at the same time. And it was just a great experience. And I knew as I was listening, I was like, there was no question it was his best up to this point. You know, it was undeniable. Overall thoughts on Hand Cannot Erase?
Speechless. I mean, I have to say it is. Yeah, I mean, you know, it's one of those albums you wish for, you know, when you're at a certain age group and it all goes to single track and streaming and all that.
Yeah,
it's it is a masterpiece. I couldn't agree more. Obviously, I listened to your review and
thank you.
Pretty much I can, you know, put my name under everything you guys said. It is from the storyline and the packaging, the production, the songs, the musicianship, the way he, you know, now takes the best of his electronic interests and stuff he does, but he does it in such a beautiful way that it doesn't feel weird or alien. I think he takes a lot of inspiration from the remix stuff he's done. He's done the Tears for Fears, right before the XTC and the Roxy music. You can see that it has, like he said, it always has an effect on the music he's composing, and I think it's just an outstanding record. I think it's the subject matter and everything about it. It's so hard to pick a favorite track for me because it changes.
They're all great.
Constant. Yeah, they're all great.
They're all great.
It changes constantly, and it's nothing is forced. There's no even something like Perfect Life, which is, and I find it interesting. I think you
we did talk to him about this
about the long version, which is on the, because I always felt like lyrically it kind of left something you know, the connection, and obviously you get that with a longer version, mm-hmm. and but there's, you know, it all makes sense. There's nothing where, well, he could have left that one off.
Right.
You know, it's just a great experience, and it's everything I love about music and about how you present it, how you do it production wise.
Yeah.
And it's just masterclass.
Yeah.
It's definitely my top 10 of all time favorite records, especially over the last 20 years. And it's, yeah, it's just great.
Me
it's
too.
Just an outstanding piece of work.
No question. So what's your pick for this one?
Well, as of today, I probably have to go with Ancestral. Come back if you want to, and remember who you are. 'Cause there's nothing here for you, my dear. Till everything must pass. When the world doesn't want you, it will never tell you why. You can shut the door, but you can't ignore. Crawl. The solo, then it just goes into this choir, you know, turmoil, and then goes into this choir thing, and it's such a strong song, and it's something that song that I always go to, you know, and it's just beautiful, just a beautiful piece of music.
I love kind of the, you know, a large portion of that is instrumental. And of course that is, you know, not counting the instrumental outro, kind of the penultimate track. So it's kind of, you know, the storytelling through lyric kind of stops and music takes over, which I think is a great, great way to kind of push the plot forward without handing it to you, you know.
Right.
The one thing that I've always, and I'm glad I can talk about it here, when we did the episode for Hand Cannot Erase,
right?
It was after we saw the show, I believe, because I think we reviewed the show as well. Yeah. And as I listened to this album after that, I got really, really into that track, and I don't think that I was as well versed in it when we did the episode. So I need to write that wrong and just really, really sing that song's praises like you did. It really just goes to great places, and you know, the lyric refrains that come back are haunting and just beautiful. I'm gonna kind of take a turn and let's listen to a little bit of the title track, Hand Cannot Erase.
Oh yeah.
Together every day.
think this is brilliant pop. And of course, when it comes to Stephen Wilson and pop, when we get into the next album, we'll have more to talk about there. But I think this is a perfectly crafted song with a killer chorus.
Absolutely.
And not even that, just the kind of arrangement changes that take place when it breaks down later on, I think, and just when those power chords come in, the dun, 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 it's so great.
It's, I think it's, for me, it's my favorite pop song of his. I think it's such a strong, you know, where he can really flex his muscles, where he kind of says, well, if I want to do pop, I can do that.
Yeah.
You know, I show you. And,
but it fits. Yeah, it totally fits.
Oh, totally.
You know, because
that's the beauty of it.
Like, Perfect Life was the first song that kind of got released to YouTube, which is, again, kind of in the postcard vein, but even more sparse of kind of, you know, the electronic, ethereal backing with a spoken word. And then he comes in and sings, and then all of a sudden, choirs of voice, you know, another song that opens up in a huge way. And then Hand Cannot Erase came after that. And there were enough comments about being put off by the pop. But I mean, it doesn't, it totally works in the context of the album. It doesn't take away from it at all. And it is a brilliantly written pop song.
Absolutely. Yeah. Like I say, it's nothing. His force is just flows, and he came off, you know, First Regret and 3 Years Older, which is, you know, a big, big song. And then it just feels, nothing feels forced. Everything, you know, even the instrumental, you know, and it's just, you know, and then Trans Science and, you know, going into that, and then the end, you know, Happy Returns is obviously
a beautiful
ridiculous
ending.
Song.
Yeah, oh, beautiful.
Oh, God. God, it's again, you know, and it's, I mean, I think it's really, really his peak in terms of songwriting and how to put a record together and a cohesive record. And and it went to number 3 in Germany. I just looked it up. Yeah,
amazing.
Yeah, it did.
I remember when we were listening the first time, and when Happy Returns came on, as soon as he delivered that last line, my blood went cold, and it was just like, God, what an album, what an experience this album has been. Like, I can't wait to just listen to the whole thing again. Like, it's so great. It's so great.
Yeah.
And even, like, you know, as you said, like, the instrumental Regret Number 9, sounds like it could be right off a 70s rock album. You know, those the organ solo, amazing. There's
He's great.
Yeah,
he's
so
great on that record.
Adam Holtzman. Yeah. And of course,
Adam Holtzman is just
another epic routine, which is just a sad, sad, incredibly sad song. Again, rivaling the, you know, the Raven That Refused to Sing in terms of sad subject matter and video. But just perfectly done. And of course, the debut of Ninette Taieb on his records, who he would continue to work with.
She's great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, Hand Cannot Erase, a masterpiece. We can agree on that, yes?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Hands down.
Yes. So,
what do you think of the. I mean, that's the time I saw him. Does he play to a seated audience in the States? Or is it standing?
It's usually seated. I think that he is asked, if I remember correctly, he has asked the audience to stand.
Right.
You know what? I'm trying to remember. I think on this tour, it was standing. I think maybe the other tours, it was not. And we had.
No, I saw him here in Munich, and it was at a classical theater place. So everybody was seating.
Oh, wow.
Sitting. And I don't know. I mean, it sounded great, but I thought it was a really odd place to put him. You know, I don't know. I don't know if it really benefited the show. The show was great, and you know, the visuals and all that, and the musicianship. But I felt like to have this kind of, you know, show in a seated, you know, classical orchestra venue was a wrong choice.
Yeah, I understand that. That makes sense. Yeah, I'm pretty sure we had we were in the front row for that show, right in front of him. So I know that we were standing the whole time. But it's great because there are pictures. There's a photographer in Philly that always photographed Porcupine Tree and Stephen Wilson when he came around. So there are some great pictures that Megan and I are both in, where you can see us right in front of them, which is wonderful. But
that's great.
Yeah, this album, absolutely great. Can't recommend it enough. There should be something there for everyone. Please check out our episode on this if you haven't. I don't remember what the episode was like. It's been years, but if any
it's a great episode.
Well, thank
it's
you.
It's a really great episode.
Thank you. If any of my joy from that show comes through, just an amazing, amazing concert.
And Eric was there as well, right? And Eric isn't that much of a Stephen Wilson.
No, he is tolerated it because he's my co-host. You know, we've had those episodes where we've been tolerant of the other, and I think the Porcupine Tree and the Stephen Wilson episodes are ones where he was very kind. But then again, it was Eric that set up the interview, so you know, so that was which I'm incredibly thankful for. But yeah, it's just never been Eric's cup of tea, you know. But he listened and he took notes, so I'm very thankful for that, you know, and did it twice.
Okay.
So and then of course a compilation follows, September 2015, Transience, which I think was first released on vinyl.
Yes.
And then a CD later on with an extra track, I believe. Was it Happiness 3 wasn't on the vinyl?
Exactly.
Yeah, and then it was on the CD. But it's the first place where you can find the start of Stephen Wilson re-recording his Porcupine Tree material. On this, you find a cover of Lazarus, which of course...
Great track.
Oh, I love that
track.
From Deadwing, which is a great Porcupine Tree record. This is something that he would do again on the next release, which came out January 2016. It is an EP called 4.5.
Let me go back to the compilation. Why?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Because I wanted to ask you that. Why do you think... he did that because it was a huge departure. It was his face on the record, full on headshot, which is something that he hasn't done up to that point. And it felt like a best of compilation, you know. And I thought, well, he's just going to do it for the vinyl thing. I get that, and then it was released on CD. And it's, you know, it's maybe his not most accessible songs, but it's definitely not his most daring songwriting on there.
It takes lengths to not include difficult songs.
Why do you think he did that? Why do you think he did that?
That's a good question.
Is it contractual obligation where he kind of wanted to do something? He knew he wanted to do something more commercial, and he just kind of felt, well, I'm just going to put this out so people can listen to kind of a best of.
You know, it's an interesting question because I do remember, I think, let me check out the links here. I seem to recall that the press for this kind of labeled it as a compilation of his more accessible work.
Right.
Let's see. Yeah, this new set is a personally curated compilation of songs recorded between 2002 and 2015, and the idea was to highlight the more accessible side of the musician and songwriter's output. 2002? That's 2002?
No.
Yeah, that's not right. And then the wiki page says 2003. What's that early? There's nothing.
No.
That's weird. Yeah, something.
2015 it is, right?
Yeah. Well, no, it says songs done between 2003 and 2015, but Insurgents was 2008. There's nothing before that. I'm not sure exactly what that would mean, unless it was, unless he had pieces of songs around that ended up becoming something else. Anyway.
Strange.
So it said to highlight the more accessible side, but it, interestingly enough about it, the vinyl, which of course was, I thought that was going to be the only issue of this. It's a it's a three-sided vinyl edition with etching on the fourth side. It's got the lyrics to Happy Returns etched on the vinyl.
Right.
So I never took this as more than kind of a collector's, just something geared at collectors. You know,
okay.
I didn't think really at the time that anybody needing to get into the accessible side of Steven Wilson would likely be clicking on a Spotify playlist and not buying a double record set. So it is a strange compilation to me.
It is.
I don't know where it fits. It's out of place. I'm glad it exists because it's got some extra stuff on it. But you do bring up a good point because it is very curious. So I know that you're a huge fan of 4 and a Half. An EP that was released in 2016, January.
Yes.
Which is kind of, I know that you've kind of talked to me about it being the bridge between Hand Cannot Erase and To the Bone. So,
that's how it feels to me.
Yeah. Your thoughts on this and your key track?
My key track would be My Book of Regrets, which is, the first song. It's, obviously he re-recorded Don't Hate Me, which is, Porcupine Tree song. He did that with Nina, which is, great version. There's some pretty much, I think he said it's leftovers mainly of stuff he composed for Hank Cannot Erase, and which just didn't fit the subject matter or the flow of the album and all that. So and I have to say, at the time I didn't get the album at all. I knew that obviously you release stuff which you've done for the previous record, and then, but he's done that for his the limited edition of all of his albums.
Right. You would have thought that all the bonus tracks were there.
So I thought, so why is he doing that? Why does he have to do this? I mean, is he? It felt off. First Transcience, and then this, and I thought something. I don't know. Something feels odd here.
Yeah.
And then with a new record coming out and his move to more commercial and new label Universal and all that, it made much more sense to me. And I, like I told you, I listened to, Hand Cannot Erase, 4 and a Half, and To the Bone together, and it just makes total sense.
Okay.
It's just, for me, it's a bridge to what he's going to do next. And it's for me, it's out of the it's not even, I wouldn't even rank it, but I like it, and I think it's a good, there's some good tracks on it.
Okay. So as it's a bridge to the Bone, let's jump to that, because I think we'll both have a lot to say about this. Being the most recent Steven Wilson solo album, released August 18th, 2017, of course, this was kind of teased a lot before the album came out. I think there were 5 songs that were previewed on YouTube to various kind of jeers and so. Kind of ignoring those songs as they were released, let's kind of take the album as an album. It's hard for me to, there are days where I would put this above Hand Cannot Erase because I don't think there's a bad track on it. Hand Cannot Erase has what that has going for it is its concept. But yeah. If you're going to take all these songs individually, there are songs in here that absolutely stand up.
Absolutely.
I think this is a perfect album as well.
It is. It is my second favorite. The only thing that where, you know, and it's a close call, and I know we've been going back and forth, and when you listen to it, and I got it. It really comes down to if I look at the pop songs of each album.
Yeah.
I think Hand Cannot Erase is a stronger track than Permeating.
Yeah.
It's just that simple. The rest is on par. There's not a weak track on it.
No.
But I think if I would have be him, or you know, the A&R, I think Hand Cannot Erase is a much better representative of his pop sensibility.
Yeah.
Than Permeating. I know that he wanted to do Permeating. He wanted to get that Electric Light Orchestra and ABBA itch, you know, out, and you can see that, you know, it's a different video. He's much more colorful.
Yeah.
He's much more, he wants to be more accessible. And I totally get that. I think just as a track, as a standalone pop track, I think Hand Cannot Erase is the bad track. And that's why I would say if Hand Cannot Erase is 100, then this album is 99.10 or something like that.
I agree.
So,
but I don't dislike Permeating. I know he's gotten a lot of criticism.
I like Permeating.
Yeah, I don't understand the criticism about him going pop. I don't feel that Permeating is that far removed. It's major key, but I mean, he's kind of done, like, you can look at a song like, you know, Four Chords That Made a Million or something like that. It's not like
he's done that before.
He's gone for pop. Yeah, this isn't new, right? You know,
exactly. And people who've been following his remix work, and he's been so vocal about his how he loves, you know, one of the records that really influenced it is Donna Summer.
Love to Love You, Baby.
Love to Love You.
Yeah.
I mean, and he's an advocate for ABBA. He always said, you know, that's one of his most favorite bands of all time.
Yeah.
So it's not unexpected.
No.
You know, it's not. And if you were a little bit open and an open fan of his, you saw that coming.
Yeah.
You saw it coming because, and then, you know, what I love about this album is obviously his references, you know, Peter Gabriel and Tears for Fears and Kate Bush and
Talk Talk. Yeah.
And, again, you know, he does a very accessible for his, you know, for his kind of, repertoire accessible record, but it still is not weak. You know, he doesn't dumb down. He doesn't dumb down his stuff. The production is ridiculously good.
Yes.
There's some outstanding songs, you know, Refugee, and for me, you know, the stuff that really, and I remember I sent it to you.
Yes.
And for me, it's Pariah. I think that's it's such a ridiculously good song.
Is that the song you're picking?
Yeah.
All right, let's pop a little bit of Pariah in right here.
So bright, you're beginning.
think the two of them, I think he found his musical soulmate in her.
Oh,
they're so great together.
She kills it. She so kills it. And I think that's also something that very much to his, you know, honor and him as an artist, he knows that, you know, he just gives her the spotlight.
Yeah.
You know, he doesn't shy away from letting someone, you know, who's that good and he feels strong about supporting, taking that song to totally different level.
He knows his limits as a vocalist. You know, she is a great extension for what he can do, you know, like those, he can kind of give her the really sweeping things that he just couldn't do vocally, you know,
exactly.
And just, it really has given a whole, you know, it's opened up so much in his music, I think, you know, and not just, you know, even back to the last album with Routine, you know, her kind of guttural scream at the end of that song is the pivotal point of that song, you know, and he's,
yeah, that's true.
He gives that to her, which I think is great, you know, absolutely great. I think that song is great. I think all these songs are great. My God, I can't even narrow it down. You know, it's interesting going through this.
I had Refugee
That's a great one. It's a great one. To the Bone, the title track's got harmonica on it. Kind of a dirty harmonica. It's great.
Oh, it is so great. It sounds odd on paper, but it is so it's so amazing.
I remember reading about it, and I was like, oh, this isn't going to work. And then I listened to it. I was like, this is perfect. So great.
Exactly.
Nowhere Now is very Blackfield with the harmonies. Permanating is a great pop song. And you know what? When it comes down to pop songs, we don't even have to go back as far as Porcupine Tree. On Blackfield, the Welcome to My DNA album, the song Waving, which I think might be the one track that Stephen Wilson wrote the music for, is so incredibly pop and maybe the lowest point on that record for me. You know, it's not like he hasn't done this. But anyway, I think I'm going to go with my pick, and it really could be any of these songs. They're all perfect. My pick would be another pick with Ninette, which is People Who Eat Darkness.
Yeah.
Just the drive on this track, kind of the stop-starty guitar rhythm bits, and just that We Eat Darkness chorus where their vocals are pushed really far back. Just a production tour de force. It's so great.
And then the ending, where it just gets quiet. You know, he really, you know, he gets so angry in the with you know this, I can hear you fucking your girlfriend through the wall, and then it just,
there goes our explicit tag that for this episode.
and then and then the ending is just it's just amazing. Again, you know, with all this stuff, you know, like To the Bone, Detonation as well.
Oh, the guitar solo. Guitar solo on Detonation.
Yeah, and then he just sits on that groove.
Yes.
You know, with a percussion. And then it's just, it has like this Grace Jones, Trevor Horn kind of way. It just sits on that groove. And it's just...
the bongos.
And it sounds... Yeah. And it just sounds great. It could be so lame.
Yeah.
You know, it could be so lame. And he does it, and he takes... Like you said at the very beginning, he takes everything that I love about certain musical genres, and he just incorporates it into his music, makes it his own, and it just sounds perfect.
Agreed. Yeah, it should be noted that Nick Begg is only playing bass on two songs. Stephen Wilson's guitars on most of it, bass. He's playing keyboards all over the record. This is maybe a lot more Stephen Wilson than any of his solo albums since the first, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
But just so great. I mean, really, you could take Hand Cannot Erase and this, and you got two perfect albums. And you know, as you said, Hand Cannot Erase, maybe a hair above this. But, you know, when you had gotten this and we were going back and forth and you were talking about it, you know, your enthusiasm for it was just off the charts, and you were absolutely spot
because
on.
Because I was to say, I felt the same way like you do. You know, I'm always kind of anxiously waiting for every release and say, well, oh man, I think this one gonna let me down.
Yeah,
this one's gonna have two great tracks on it, and then maybe three okay tracks, and you know, and then, you know, I listened to it and it just got better and better and better. And I was just like, oh God, thank goodness.
Definitely.
You know, he's not done it. And, you know, and I trust him, you know, it's a matter if you can trust an artist you love that not to let you down and to, no matter which direction he takes, I think that's what it's all about. And there are not many people, you know, like Peter Gabriel is another one. And for me, and I just trust him. His choices are so spot on for me personally. I trust him totally. And I think that's just makes him great for me.
Yeah. And once again, you got a bonus disc that has a lot of demos, but then you get this song "Adore Marked Summer," which is another masterpiece that isn't even on the record. You know, just tucked away on a disc of extra songs.
They sound like finished product.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It sounds like finished product.
Yeah. I think "Adore Marked Summer" was. I think that one was probably slated to be on the album and pulled off. And then let's not forget we have. We have a track on the, there's a 7-inch single enclosed in there. Just tons of music.
Again, 5.1 mix, you know, everything the heart desires. I mean, it's just great.
Yeah.
Just great, great stuff.
I'm kind of glad because, you know, this kind of approach, we did an episode on Skylarking. And I was taking a look at the deluxe for that. And of course, Stephen Wilson had a hand in remixing that.
Yeah, and I think it's his favorite. Yeah.
And really good. But it was the same kind of deal. You got the album. You got the instrumental version of the album. It should be said that for both Hand Cannot Erase and To the Bone, not only do you get a handful of tracks that didn't make the album and demos, but each of them have a complete instrumental version of the album as well on the Blu-ray. Which again is a great listen. You know, there's so much stuff hidden, those layers hidden under the vocals. When you strip the vocals away, there's so much to hear on these songs. Two masterpieces. Ending on two masterpieces.
Two masterpieces. Back there. Are you gonna? You're going out to see him.
April.
Right? When?
April. Yeah.
Okay. You know, I've seen him on German television. He's done some stuff on French television. I think you know, the only thing that I kind of not left a bitter taste in my mouth, but I read an interview where he I think he's a little bit annoyed with his lack of obviously mass appeal, especially in the UK.
Yeah.
And I think he felt he made a conscious move, you know, new management, new label, you know, major label, all his stuff is now on streaming platform, which I think is all great. And I think that, you know, I think he said in one interview that he just hates Thom Yorke's guts because he has like that adoration, you know, as a cult artist. And I think it's interesting with him. You know, he likes to be a nerd. He doesn't pay a lot of, you know, attention on his you know, visuals himself. Same glasses, same haircut. He still looks like he's 25, although he's 50.
Amazing.
yeah, I don't know where he gets that from. But on the other hand, he's just really craving, craving mainstream, not success, but just
recognition.
Recognition, yeah. And I think at some interviews he just said, well, you know, I just want to. He felt a little bit bitter. It sounded, but. Then on the other hand, I think, I don't know if he made new grounds with this record. I don't know if he achieved what he set out for himself to achieve with this record. It's hard to tell. I know his mainstream TV appearance on German television, I mean, really stepped up. I mean, it was from zero to, I think he did like 3 or 4 shows.
Really?
I don't know if that translated into record sale. I honestly doubt it. I don't. And if you look on Spotify, I think you know. Obviously, you know. I think Pariah is the most streamed stuff. I'd be curious. I'd be curious to see if this record has sold substantially more than Hank Cannot Erase in Germany. I doubt it. It had the same chart position, but other than that, I think it. I think it's just, you know, he hasn't sold out anything. That was my biggest concern, and he's done such an amazing, tremendous job with this record. So, you know, yeah, I don't know. Maybe it's him turning 50.
Maybe.
And I think what he said, which is curious, is he's not making any profit off his touring.
Right.
And he's not making any, because he put so much effort and money into everything, the production. He goes places, you know, South America, where he's huge. And I don't know, maybe he feels like it's time for him to you know, make some substantial amount of money. I don't know. You know, for him to go next, because I think that's something that, you know, we wanted to briefly touch base on. Mm-hmm. I think it's soundtrack. I think he's so ready to do soundtracks for a big feature movie. His music, if not his music, which music does, you know, it's just screaming for it. And I know he said it numerous times that he would love to do it.
Did you see the video game soundtrack?
No, I haven't yet. I've got it, obviously, and okay. I like it, but I haven't seen the visual. I've seen the teasers and all that, but okay. I haven't seen the.
But you've heard visuals. You've heard the soundtrack.
I heard the soundtrack.
Yeah. So essentially, it's a video game soundtrack. I actually haven't heard it. So it's based on pieces of songs from his solo catalog or remixed segments. Is that what I understand?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, yeah, I do have to agree. A soundtrack, you know, kind of an instrumental soundtrack would be right in his wheelhouse. Oh, and yeah. I think obviously something that he's wanted to do since Deadwing, because I remember having been a fan then, you know, all of his kind of I remember you'd hear as much about kind of the Deadwing screenplay that he was working on at the same time as the record.
And, exactly.
And of course, you know, nothing ever came of it. But yeah, I would see him very ripe for something like that.
And then maybe you're right. Maybe I got it wrong in the beginning. Maybe it was Deadwing and not the incident.
Oh, that's probably right. Yeah. That may have been what it was.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. Deadwing was definitely a film project, and I think at some point he actually released pieces of the script. But yeah, that you know, it kind of. I even remember after the album came out, there was kind of talk about you know still shopping around the idea for the film, and just nothing happened with it. So why don't we kind of end on this, just kind of as an aside. Do you check out his other, you know, he's got tons of side projects. Do you, aside from Porcupine Tree, are you into any of the other stuff?
Blackfield. I love Blackfield. Oh, I love Blackfield. No Man, I really enjoy.
Yeah, I'm not as familiar with No Man.
Yeah, I think I listened to some best of, but I think the first Blackfield record is outstanding.
Beautiful,
And other than that, it's, you know, I try to follow him. I'm following his remix work a lot.
Okay.
And I'm trying to get as much, you know, the Tears for Fears. I got that, which he did an amazing job singing songs from the Big Chair.
Great remix of that.
Oh,
it's like he stripped all of the 80s away and made like a perfect record.
It, right?
Yes,
We talked. It sounds so modern.
Yeah, now.
And you know, obviously, I'm holding my breath now for 2 years that they're gonna release the Tears for Fears. Seeds of Love.
Yeah, that's supposed to be next, right?
Yeah, it's done.
Okay,
it's done for 1.5 years. It's one of my favorite all-time records. I think Tears for Fears is sitting on it. He said that there's going to be a new Tears for Fears studio album in the summer, and then that's going to be the next in line, which probably is going to be. Then December. So, okay. And I'm going to see Tears for Fears with my wife in Berlin. So I'm really looking forward.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. I'm a huge fan.
That's awesome. I also really like the Bass Communion stuff, which I realize isn't for everybody.
I haven't listened to it.
You know, it's interesting. You know, it's soundscape kind of stuff.
Right.
But, you know, there are times I kind of put it on at work and it's good. It's good background, you know. I just think it's interesting more than anything else. But like Ghosts on Magnetic Tape is great. I had had that on vinyl and would listen to that late at night. And it's just kind of like it, you know, it's music that kind of presents a vibe. A lot of drone stuff. But, you know, I always thought it was kind of a neat offshoot from his other stuff.
Yeah. What I really liked was the Storm Corrosion.
An awesome record. So that's, good.
Yeah, it is. But that's a tough one. And I what I really loved about it is that everybody was really, you know, oh man, it's Mikael and Steven, and this is gonna be it. You know, like this amazing prog rock, and masterpiece, and then it's just like this, the opposite. It's this orchestral, you know, like so stripped down, but so and I love that. I love that he's just and both of them are just like, yeah, well, you know, sorry, but we're doing something else.
Yeah, no, I thought it was great.
And, Yeah, I love that record.
That came out 2012. So yeah, that was between, I guess that was right before, right after Grace for Drowning, I guess, right? 2011?
Yep. Another question I have for you.
Yep.
Which I always, why do you think he doesn't write for other artists?
Oh, that's a good question.
Because he's so, you know, I mean, he's not like Prince, but I'm sure he's constantly, you know, coming up with stuff. He's, you know, his taste is so all over the place, so he could write for great pop rock artists, or, but he hasn't done it yet, and I wonder why that is. I have no answer to it.
I think that his stuff is very, I think that the stuff he writes is so him. It's so, like the soundscapes are so him. It's like, I kind of feel like what he sits down and does with a guitar and a vocal is fleshed out by so much of his soundscape, whether it be, you know, he's kind of reused pieces from his past again. And I kind of think that in terms of like just sitting down and like writing chords and a melody, I don't kind of see him as that kind of writer. I kind of see him as somebody that like starts building and building and building. And then I think that, you know, when he gets that emotionally invested, I think it becomes kind of just producing something for somebody else and kind of layering, you know, kind of what he did with Opeth, you know. I think that's more his MO is to kind of inform somebody else's music with his colors than it is for somebody to color on his work. You know what I mean?
Right. Got it.
That's kind of how I would say
something.
It.
No, I agree. That's kind of the same. Because I had that same, basically I asked, why doesn't Peter Gabriel write for other people?
Yeah.
You know, and he's like the same kind of, let's say, or Kate Bush or, you know, like the people that he also feels pretty much attached to as artists, and they do the same way. So I think you're spot on.
Yeah,
absolutely.
It's a catalog that you really can't go wrong with. I mean,
it's a gift. It's a gift that keeps on giving. It's ridiculous.
It is. If there's anybody that's listened to this that isn't familiar with Stephen Wilson, I would hope that the clips we played would
Do yourself a favor.
Yeah. I mean,
there's so much to discover.
Yeah. If you are a listener that doesn't listen to music through, you know, a portable device, if you're somebody that, you know, I don't mean necessarily vinyl, but just like, if you enjoy like sitting in front of a stereo system and relaxing and listening to a record, instead of it being, you know, background noise in your car or, you know, while you're doing something else, these are great, great records with lots of textures and lots of layers. And, you know, and just the more you explore them, the more rewarding they are. Like, there are so many things that, you know, years later are opening up and making more sense to me. You know, he's just an incredibly thoughtful, I can't even say songwriter, because it's the whole package. Like, it's what he presents as a whole. You know, nothing he's done has been tossed off. Like, everything is, you know, it's this group of songs with this concept around it and this packaging. And he's an artist that gives care to the whole experience. And I appreciate that in this day and age when you lose so much of that via the internet. It's, you know, it's back to the days when, you know, opening a record sleeve and studying it as you listen to the record, is taken even a step further with the books that come with these special editions. Just absolutely amazing.
Yeah. I think he, you know, it doesn't seem like he, he's involved in every aspect of his creative output and you know, I think nothing gets, you know, passed by, and nothing gets, we're gonna slam on a
some kind of artwork on it, and we're just gonna do this. And and like he said, you know, I mean, I think I read an interview a couple of years ago. He sacrificed family for music.
Yes.
I think he's, I think that's a very bold statement. For him to be that honest, and I think that it really shows in his work, the love and care he takes to do that.
And he's tireless with it.
He's tireless with it, and then, you know, he doesn't brag about it. He's very modest, he's just great. I just love him.
Yeah.
I think he's an amazing artist, and I'm so curious what's to come. And he's one of these people where, you know, I think he can be 75 and composing, orchestral scores, and I would still be, you know, in awe and a fan of his. And that's great.
I completely agree. Yeah. Completely agree. Henning, this has been great, because
this has been a long time in the making.
Yes.
And it's been an absolute pleasure.
Yeah. There aren't a whole lot of people that, that would want to sit and talk Stephen Wilson with me for 2 hours.
Oh yeah.
So I'm so completely glad. For those of you who don't know, Henning was a huge part of making the Rock and Pod Expo happen, and of course that's where we met face to face for the first time. Such a pleasure to meet you. Glad you're my friend, and so glad that and you've introduced me to some music. So glad that we have kept in touch, and I hope that we can do this again.
Absolutely, would be my pleasure, my honor, and and thanks for taking the time and giving me this opportunity to chat with you. It didn't feel like a podcast; it just felt like a casual conversation about our favorite artists, which is great. It's the highest compliment.
Yeah, I mean, this conversation could have happened at the expo, and I think it probably started, and we were like, let's just save it. Let's save it for when we do the episode.
Let's not talk about it.
Right. Friends, thank you for listening. You can find us, of course, on Facebook and iTunes under the Pods and Sods Network, and online at podsodcast.com. where the whole back catalog resides. You can find the Pods and Sods episodes, all of my sidecasts, all of Eric's interviews, and of course quite a few episodes about Stephen Wilson and Porcupine Tree, if you're so inclined to do so. Appreciate your support as always, and again, Henning, thank you for being part of this.
Thank you. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.